That's a great trick, Sheriff Pangborn, Brian said in a colorless, emotionless voice. Really? Thanks. Glad you liked it. Do you know what I want to talk to you about, Brian? I guess I do, Brian said, and Alan was suddenly sure the boy was going to confess to breaking the windows. Right here on this street corner, he was going to confess, and Alan was going to take a giant step toward unraveling what had happened between Nettie and Wilma. But Brian said nothing more. He only looked up at Alan with his tired, slightly bloodshot eyes. What happened, son? Alan asked in that same quiet voice. What happened while you were at the Jerzyk's house? Don't know, Brian said. His voice was listless. But I dreamed about it last night. Sunday night, too. I dream about going to that house. Only in my dream, I see what's really making all the noise. And what's that, Brian? A monster, Brian said. His voice did not change, but a large tear had appeared in each of his eyes, growing on the lower arcs of the lids. In my dream, I knock on the door instead of riding away like I did, and the door opens, and it's a monster, and it eats me up. The tears brimmed, then rolled slowly down the disturbed skin of Brian Rusk's cheeks. And yes, Alan thought, it could be that, too, simple fright. The sort of fright a little kid might feel when he opens the bedroom door at the wrong time and sees his mother and father screwing. Only, because he's too young to know the look of screwing, he thinks they're fighting. Maybe he even thinks, if they're making a lot of noise, that they're trying to kill each other. But it didn't feel right. It was just that simple. It felt as if this kid were lying his head off, in spite of the haggard look in his eyes, the look that said, I want to tell you everything. What did that mean? Alan didn't know for sure, but experience taught him that the likeliest solution was that Brian knew whoever had thrown the rocks. Maybe it was someone Brian felt obliged to protect, or maybe the rock thrower knew Brian had seen him, and Brian knew that. Maybe the kid was afraid of reprisals. A person threw a bunch of rocks into the Jerzyk's house, Alan said in a low and, he hoped, soothing voice. Yes, sir, Brian said, almost sighed. I guess so. I guess it could have been that. I thought they were fighting, but it could have been someone throwing rocks. Crash, boom, bang. The whole rhythm section was the Purple Gang, Alan thought, but did not say. You thought they were fighting? Yes, sir. Is that what you really thought? Yes, sir. Alan sighed. Well, you know what it was now, and you know it was a bad thing to do. Throwing rocks through somebody's windows is a pretty serious business, even if nothing else comes of it. Yes, sir. But this time, something else did come of it. You know that, don't you, Brian? Yes, sir. Those eyes, looking up at him from that calm, pallid face. Alan began to understand two things. This boy did want to tell him what had happened, but he was almost certainly not going to do so. You look very unhappy, Brian. Yes, sir? Yes, sir. Does that mean you are unhappy? Brian nodded, and two more tears spilled from his eyes and rolled down his cheeks. Alan felt two strong, conflicting emotions, deep pity and wild exasperation. What are you unhappy about, Brian? Tell me. I used to have this really nice dream, Brian said in a voice which was almost too low to hear. It was stupid, but it was nice just the same. It was about Miss Radcliffe, my speech teacher. Now I know it's stupid. I didn't used to know, and that was better. But guess what? I know more than that now. Those dark, terribly unhappy eyes rose to meet Alan's again. The dream I have, the one about the monster who throws the rocks. It scares me, Sheriff Pangborn. But what makes me unhappy are the things I know now. It's like knowing how the magician does his tricks. He nodded his head a little, and Alan could have sworn Brian was looking at the band of his watch. Sometimes it's better to be dumb. I know that now. Alan put a hand on the boy's shoulder. Brian, let's cut through the bullshit, all right? Tell me what happened. Tell me what you saw and what you did. I came to see if they wanted their driveway shoveled this winter, the boy said in a mechanical, rote voice that frightened Alan badly. The kid looked like almost any American child of 11 or 12, Converse sneakers, jeans, a T-shirt with Bart Simpson on it. But he sounded like a robot which has been badly programmed and is now in danger of overloading. For the first time, Alan wondered if Brian Rusk had maybe seen one of his own parents throwing rocks at the Jerzyk house. I heard noises, the boy was continuing. He spoke in simple declarative sentences, talking as police detectives are trained to talk in court. They were scary noises, bangs and crashes and things breaking. So I rode away as fast as I could. The lady from next door was out on her stoop. She asked me what was going on. I think she was scared, too. Yes, Alan said. Jillian Miss Liberski. I talked to her. He touched the Playmate cooler, sitting crookedly in the basket of Brian's bike. He was not unaware of the way Brian's lips tightened when he did this. Did you have this cooler with you on Sunday morning, Brian? Yes, sir, Brian said. He wiped his cheeks with the back of his hands and watched Alan's face warily. What was in it? Brian said nothing, but Alan thought his lips were trembling. What was in it, Brian? Brian said a little more nothing. Was it full of rocks? Slowly and deliberately, Brian shook his head. No. For the third time, Alan asked, what was in it?
Same thing that's in it now,
Brian whispered. May I open it and see?
Yes, sir,
Brian said in his listless voice. I guess so. Alan rotated the cover to one side and looked into the cooler. It was full of baseball cards, Tops, Fleer, Donruss. Those are my traders. I carry them with me almost everywhere, Brian said.
You carry them with you?
Yes, sir.
Why, Brian? Why do you cart a cooler filled with baseball cards around with you?
I told you, they're traders. You never know when you'll get a chance to make a boss trade with someone. I'm still looking for a Joe Foy. He was on the Impossible Dream Team in 67, and a Mike Greenwell rookie card. The Gator's my favorite player. And now Alan thought he saw a faint, fugitive gleam of amusement in the boy's eyes. Could almost hear a telepathic voice chanting, "Fooled ya! Fooled ya!" But surely that was only him, only his own frustration mocking the boy's voice. Wasn't it? Well, what did you expect to find inside that cooler anyway? A pile of rocks with notes tied around them? Did you actually think he was on his way to do the same thing to someone else's house? Yes, he admitted. Part of him had thought that, or something like that, was exactly what was going on. Brian Rusk, the pint-sized terror of Castle Rock, the mad rocker. And the worst part was this. He was pretty sure Brian Rusk knew what was going through his head.
Fooled ya! Fooled ya, Sheriff!
Brian, please tell me what's going on around here. If you know, please tell me. Brian closed the lid of the Playmate cooler and said nothing. It made a soft little snick in the drowsy autumn afternoon. Can't say? Brian nodded slowly, meaning, Alan thought, that he was right. He couldn't say. Tell me this, at least. Are you scared? Are you scared, Brian? Brian nodded again, just as slowly. Tell me what you're scared of, son. Maybe I can make it go away. He tapped one finger lightly against the badge he wore on the left side of his uniform shirt. I think that's why they pay me to lug this star around, because sometimes I can make the scary stuff go away. Brian began, and then the police radio Alan had installed beneath the dash of the town and country wagon 3 or 4 years ago squawked to life. Unit 1, this is base. Do you copy? Over. Brian's eyes broke away from Alan's. They turned toward the station wagon and the sound of Sheila Brigham's voice, the voice of authority, the voice of the police. Alan saw that if the boy had been on the verge of telling him something, and it might only be wishful thinking to believe he had been, he wasn't anymore. His face had closed up like a clamshell. You go on home now, Brian. We're going to talk about this dream of yours more later on, okay?
Yes, sir, Brian said. I guess so.
In the meantime, think about what I said. Most of what being sheriff's about is making the scary stuff go away.
I have to go home now, Sheriff. If I don't get home pretty soon, my mom's going to be mad at me.
Alan nodded. Well, we don't want that. Go on, Brian.
He watched the boy go. Brian's head was down, and once again, he did not seem to be riding the bike so much as trudging along with it between his legs. Something was wrong there, so wrong that Alan's finding out what had happened to Wilma and Nettie seemed secondary to finding out what had put that tired, haunted expression on the kid's face. The women, after all, were dead and buried. Brian Rusk was still alive. He went to the tired old station wagon he should have traded a year ago, leaned in, grabbed the Radio Shack mic, and depressed the transmit button.
Yeah, Sheila, this is Unit 1. I copy. Come on back.
Henry Peyton called for you, Alan, Sheila said. He told me to tell you it's urgent. He wants me to patch you through to him. 10-4?
Go for it, Alan said. He felt his pulse pick up.
It may take a couple of minutes. 10-4?
That's fine. I'll be right here. Unit 1 clear.
He leaned against the side of the car in the dappled shade, mic in hand, waiting to see what was urgent in Henry Peyton's life.
By the time Polly reached home, it was 20 minutes past 3, and she felt torn in two completely different directions. On one hand, she felt a deep, drumming need to be about the errand Mr. Gaunt had given her. She didn't like to think of it in his terms as a prank. Polly Chalmers was not much of a prankster. To get it done so the Osga would finally belong to her. The concept that the dealing wasn't done until Mr. Gaunt said the dealing was done had not so much as crossed her mind. On the other hand, she felt a deep, drumming need to get in touch with Alan, to tell him exactly what had happened, or as much of it as she could remember. One thing she could remember, it filled her with shame and a low sort of horror, but she could remember it all right, was this. Mr. Leland Gaunt hated the man Polly loved, and Mr. Gaunt was doing something that was very wrong. Alan should know. Even if the Osga stopped working, he should know. You don't mean that. But yes, part of her meant exactly that. The part that was terrified of Leland Gaunt, even though she couldn't remember what exactly he had done to induce that feeling of terror. Do you want to go back to the way things were, Polly? Do you want to go back to owning a pair of hands that feel full of shrapnel? No, but neither did she want Alan hurt. Neither did she want Mr. Gaunt to do whatever he was planning to do, if it was something she suspected it was, that would hurt the town. Nor did she want to be a part of that something, by going out to the old deserted Camber place at the end of Town Road Number 3 and playing some sort of trick she didn't even understand. So these conflicting wants, each championed by its own hectoring voice, pulled at her as she walked slowly home. If Mr. Gaunt had hypnotized her in some way, she had been positive of this when she left the store, but she became less and less sure as time passed. The effects had worn off now. Polly really believed this. And she had never in her life found herself so incapable of deciding what to do next. It was as if her whole supply of some vital decision-making chemical had been stolen from her brain. In the end, she went home to do what Mr. Gaunt had advised, although she no longer precisely remembered the advice. She would check her mail, and then she would call Alan and tell him what Mr. Gaunt wanted her to do.
If you do that, the interior voice said grimly, the Osga really will stop working, and you know it.
Yes, but there was still the question of right and wrong. There was still that. She would call Alan and apologize for being so short with him and then tell him what Mr. Gaunt wanted of her. Perhaps she would even give him the envelope Mr. Gaunt had given her, the one she was supposed to put in the tin can. Perhaps. Feeling a little better, Polly put her key in the front door of her house, again rejoicing at the ease of this operation, almost without being aware of it, and turned it. The mail was in its usual place on the carpet. Not very much today. Usually there was more junk mail after the post office had taken a day off. She bent and picked it up, a cable TV brochure with Tom Cruise's smiling, impossibly handsome face on the front, one catalog from the Horchow collection and another from the Sharper Image. Also, Polly saw the one letter, and a ball of dread began to grow deep in her stomach. To Patricia Chalmers of Castle Rock, from the San Francisco Department of Child Welfare, from 666 Geary. She remembered 666 Geary so very well from her trips down there. Three trips in all. Three interviews with three aid to dependent children bureaucrats, two of whom had been men. Men who had looked at her the way you looked at a candy wrapper that had gotten stuck on one of your best shoes. The third bureaucrat had been an extremely large black woman, a woman who had known how to listen and how to laugh, and it was from this woman that Polly had finally gotten an approval. But she remembered 666 Geary, second floor, so very, very well. She remembered the way the light from the big window at the end of the hall had lain a long, milky stain on the linoleum. She remembered the echoey sound of typewriters from offices where the doors always stood open. She remembered the cluster of men smoking cigarettes by the sand-filled urn at the far end of the hall,
and how they had looked at her. Most of all, she remembered how it had felt to be dressed in her one good outfit. A dark polyester pantsuit, a white silk blouse, legs, nearly nude pantyhose, her low heels. And how terrified and lonely she had felt, for the dim second-floor corridor of 666 Geary seemed to be a place with neither heart nor soul. Her ADC application had finally been approved there, but it was the turndown she remembered, of course. The eyes of the men, how they had crawled across her breasts. They were better dressed than Norval down at the diner, but otherwise, she thought, not really much different. The mouths of the men, how they had pursed in decorous disapproval as they considered the problem of Kelton Chalmers, the bastard offspring of this little trollop, this Janie come lately, who didn't look like a hippie now, oh no, but who would undoubtedly take off her silk blouse and nice pantsuit as soon as she got out of here, not to mention her brassiere, and put on a pair of tight bell-bottom jeans and a tie-dyed blouse that would showcase her nipples. Their eyes said all that and more, and although the response of the department had come in the mail, Polly had known immediately that she would be turned down. She had wept as she left the building on each of those first two occasions, and it seemed to her now that she could remember the acid trickle of each tear as it slid down her cheek, that and the way the people on the street had looked at her. No caring in their eyes, just a certain dull curiosity. She had never wanted to think about those times or that dim second-floor hallway again, but now it was back with her. So clearly she could smell the floor polish, could see the milky reflected light from the big window, could hear the echoey, dreamy sound of old manual typewriters chewing through another day in the bowels of the bureaucracy. What did they want? Dear God, what could the people at 666 Geary want with her at this late date? Tear it up! A voice inside nearly screamed, and the command was so imperative that she came very close to doing just that. She ripped the envelope open instead. There was a single sheet of paper inside. It was a Xerox, and although the envelope had been addressed to her, she saw with astonishment that the letter was not. It was addressed to Sheriff Alan Pangborn. Her eyes dropped to the foot of the letter. The name typed below the scrawled signature was John L. Perlmutter, and this name rang a very faint bell for her. Her eyes dropped a little further, and she saw, at the very foot of the letter, the notation C.C. Patricia Chalmers. Well, this was a Xerox, not a carbon, but it still cleared up the puzzling matter of this being Alan's letter, and settled her first confused idea that it had been delivered to her by mistake. But what, in God's name? Polly sat on the shaker bench in the hallway and began to read the letter. As she did so, a remarkable series of emotions lensed across her face, like cloud formations on an unsettled, windy day. Puzzlement, understanding, shame, horror, anger, and finally, fury. She screamed aloud once, "No!" and then went back and forced herself to read the letter again, slowly, all the way to the end. San Francisco Department of Child Welfare, 666 Geary Street, San Francisco, California, 94112, September 23, 1991. Sheriff Alan J. Pangborn, Castle County Sheriff's Office, to the Municipal Building, Castle Rock, Maine, 04055. Dear Sheriff Pangborn, I am in receipt of your letter of September 1 and am writing to tell you I can offer you no help whatever in this matter. It is the policy of this department to give out information on applicants for Aid to Dependent Children, ADC, only when we are compelled to do so by a valid court order. I have shown your letter to Martin D. Chung, our chief legal counsel, who instructs me to tell you that a copy of your letter has been forwarded to the California Attorney General's office. Mr. Chung has asked for an opinion as to whether your request may be illegal in and of itself. Whatever the result of that inquiry, I must tell you that I find your curiosity about this woman's life in San Francisco to be both inappropriate and offensive. I suggest, Sheriff Pangborn, that you lay this matter to rest before you incur legal difficulties. Sincerely, John L. Perlmutter, Deputy Director, C.C., Patricia Chalmers. After her fourth reading of this terrible letter, Polly rose from the bench and walked into the kitchen. She walked slowly and gracefully, more like one who swims than one who walks. At first, her eyes were dazed and confused, but by the time she had taken the handset from the wall-mounted phone and tapped out the number of the sheriff's office on the oversized pads, they had cleared. The look which lit them was simple and unmistakable, an anger so strong it was nearly hate. Her lover had been sniffing around in her past. She found the idea simultaneously unbelievable and strangely, hideously plausible. She had done a lot of comparing herself to Alan Pangborn in the last 4 or 5 months, and that meant she had done a lot of coming off second best. His tears, her deceptive calm, which hid so much shame and hurt and secret, defiant pride. His honesty, her little stack of lies, how saint-like he had seemed, how dauntingly perfect, how hypocritical her own insistence that he put the past away. And all the time, he had been sniffing around, trying to find out the real story of Kelton Chalmers. "You bastard," she whispered, and as the telephone began to ring, the knuckles of the hand holding the telephone turned white with strain. Lester Pratt usually left Castle Rock High in the company of several friends. They would all go down to Hemp Hill's Market for sodas, then head off to someone's house or apartment for a couple of hours to sing hymns or play games or just shoot the bull. Today, however, Lester left school alone with his knapsack on his back. He disdained the traditional teacher's briefcase and his head down. If Alan had been there to watch Lester walk slowly across the school lawn toward the faculty parking lot, he would have been struck by the man's resemblance to Brian Rusk. 3 times that day, Lester had tried to get in touch with Sally to find out what in the land of Goshen had made her so mad. The last time had been during his period 5 lunch break. He knew she was at the middle school, but the closest he got to her was a callback from Mona Lawless, who taught 6th and 7th grade math and chummed with Sally. "She can't come to the phone," Mona told him, displaying all the warmth of a deep freeze stuffed with popsicles. "Why not?" he had asked, almost whined. "Come on, Mona, give." "I don't know." Mona's voice had progressed from popsicles in the deep freeze to the verbal equivalent of liquid nitrogen. "All I know is that she's been staying with Irene Lutjens. She looks like she spent all last night crying, and she says she doesn't want to talk to you." "And this is all your fault," Mona's frozen tone said. "I know that because you're a man, and all men are dog shit. This is just another specific example illustrating the general case." "Well, I don't have the slightest idea what it's all about," Lester shouted. "Will you tell her that, at least? Tell her I don't know why she's mad at me. Tell her whatever it is, it must be a misunderstanding, because I don't get it." There was a long pause. When Mona spoke again, her voice had warmed up a little. Not much, but it was a lot better than liquid nitrogen. "All right, Lester. I'll tell her." Now he raised his head, half hoping Sally might be sitting in the passenger seat of the Mustang, ready to kiss and make up. But the car was empty. The only person close to it was soft-headed Slopey Dodd, goofing around on his skateboard. Steve Edwards came up behind Lester and clapped him on the shoulder. "Les, boy, want to come over to my place for coke? A bunch of the guys said they'd drop by. We have to talk about this outrageous Catholic harassment. The big meeting's at the church tonight, don't forget, and it would be good if we YAs could present a united front when it comes to deciding what to do. I mentioned the idea to Don Hemphill, and he said, yeah, great, go for it." He looked at Lester as if he expected a pat on the head. "I can't this afternoon, Steve. Maybe another time." "Hey, Les, don't you get it? There may not be another time. The Pope's boys aren't fooling around anymore." "I can't come over," Les said. "And if you're wise," his face said, "you'll stop pushing it."
"Well, but why not?"
"Because I have to find out what the heck I did to make my girl so angry," Lester thought. "And I am going to find out, even if I have to shake it out of her." Out loud, he said, "I've got stuff to do, Steve. Important stuff. Take my word for it."
"If this is about Sally, Les..."
Lester's eyes flashed dangerously. "You just shut up about Sally." Steve, an inoffensive young man who had been set aflame by the strife over casino night, was not yet burning brightly enough to overstep the line Lester Pratt had so clearly drawn. But neither was he quite ready to give up. Without Lester Pratt, a young adult's policy meeting was a joke, no matter how many from the YA group turned out. Pitching his voice more reasonably, he said, "You know the anonymous card Bill got?" "Yes," Lester said. Reverend Rose had found it on the floor of the parsonage front hallway, the already notorious Baptist rat fuck card. The Reverend had passed it around at a hastily called Guys Only, YA meeting, because, he said, it was impossible to credit unless you saw the vile thing for yourself. It was hard to fully understand, Reverend Rose had added, the depths to which the Catholics would sink in order to stifle righteous opposition to their Satan-inspired night of gambling. Perhaps actually seeing this vile spew of filth would help these fine young men comprehend what they were up against. For do we not say that to forewarned is forearmed? Reverend Rose had finished grandly. He then produced the card. It was inside a baggie, as if those who handled it needed to be guarded from infection, and handed it around. As Lester finished reading it, he had been more than ready to ring a few sets of Catholic chimes, but now the entire affair seemed distant and somehow childish. Who really cared if the Catholics gambled for play money and gave away a few new tires and kitchen appliances? When it came down to a choice between the Catholics and Sally Ratcliffe, Lester knew which one he had to worry about. A meeting to try and work out the next step, Steve was continuing. He was starting to get hot again. We have to seize the initiative here, Les. We have to. Reverend Bill says he's worried that these so-called concerned Catholic men are through talking. Their next step may be, look, Steve, do whatever you want, but leave me out of it. Steve stopped and stared at him, clearly shocked, and just as clearly expecting Lester, normally the most even-tempered of fellows, to come to his senses and apologize. When he realized no apology was forthcoming, he started to walk back toward the school, putting distance between himself and Lester. Boy, you're in a rotten mood, he said. That's right, Lester called back truculently. He rolled his big hands into fists and planted them on his hips. But Lester was more than just angry. He hurt, damn it. He hurt all over. And what hurt the worst was his mind. And he wanted to strike out at someone. Not poor old Steve Edwards. It was just that allowing himself to get pissed at Steve seemed to have turned on a switch inside him. That switch had sent electricity flowing to a lot of mental appliances, which were usually dark and silent. For the first time since he'd fallen in love with Sally, Lester, normally the most placid of men, felt angry at her, too. What right had she to tell him to go to hell? What right did she have to call him a bastard? She was mad about something, was she? All right, she was mad. Maybe he had even given her something to be mad about. He hadn't the slightest idea what that something might be, but say, just for the sake of argument, that he had. Did that give her the right to fly off the handle at him, without even doing him the courtesy of asking for an explanation first? Did it give her the right to stay with Irene Lugin so he couldn't crash his way into wherever she was, or to refuse all his telephone calls? Or to employ Mona Lawless as a go-between? I'm going to find her, Lester thought, and I'm going to find out what's eating her. Then, once it's out, we can make up. And after we do, I'm going to give her the same lecture I give my freshmen when basketball practice starts, about how trust is the key to teamwork. He stripped off his pack, chucked it into the back seat, and climbed into his car. As he did, he saw something sticking out from under the passenger seat, something black. It looked like a wallet. Lester seized it eagerly, thinking at first that it must be Sally's. If she had left it in his car at some point during the long holiday weekend, she must have missed it by now. She'd be anxious. And if he could relieve her anxiety about her lost wallet, the rest of their conversation might become a little easier. But it wasn't Sally's. He saw that as soon as he got a close look at the item which had been under the passenger seat. It was black leather. Sally's was scuffed blue suede and much smaller. Curiously, he opened it. The first thing he saw struck him like a hard blow to the solar plexus. It was John LaPointe's driver's license. What, in the name of God, had John LaPointe been doing in his car? Sally had it all weekend, his mind whispered. So just what the hell do you think he was doing in your car? No, he said. No way. She wouldn't. She wouldn't see him. No way in hell. But she had seen him. She and Deputy John LaPointe had gone out together for over a year, in spite of the developing bad feelings between Castle Rock's Catholics and Baptists. They had broken up before the current hoorah over casino night, but Lester got out of the car again and flipped through the wallet's see-through pockets. His sense of incredulity grew. Here was LaPointe's sheriff's office ID. In the picture on it, he was wearing the little mustache he'd cultivated when he'd been going out with Sally. Lester knew what some fellows called mustaches like that, pussy ticklers. Here was John LaPointe's fishing license. Here was a picture of John LaPointe's mother and father. Here was his hunting license. And here? Here? Lester stared fixedly at the snapshot he'd come upon. It was a snapshot of John and Sally. A snap of a fellow and his best girl. They were standing in front of what looked like a carnival shooting gallery. They were looking at each other and laughing. Sally was holding a big stuffed teddy bear. LaPointe had probably just won it for her. Lester stared at the picture. A vein had risen in the center of his forehead, quite a prominent one, and it pulsed steadily. What had she called him? A cheating bastard? Well, look who's talking, Lester Pratt muttered. Rage began to build up in him. It happened very quickly, and when someone touched him on the shoulder, he swung around, dropping the wallet and doubling up his fists. He came very close to punching inoffensive, stuttering Slopey Dodd into the middle of next week. Coach Pratt? Slopey asked. His eyes were big and round, but he didn't look frightened. Interested, but not frightened. Are you okay? I'm fine, Lester said thickly. Go home, Slopey. Put an egg in your shoe and beat it. You don't have any business with that skateboard in the faculty parking lot. He bent down to pick up the dropped wallet, but Slopey was 2 feet closer to the ground and beat him to it. He looked curiously at LaPointe's driver's license photo before handing the wallet back to Coach Pratt. Yep, Slopey said. That's the same guy, all right. He hopped onto his board and prepared to ride away. Lester grabbed him by the shirt before he could do so. The board squirted out from under Slopey's foot, rolled away on its own, hit a pothole, and turned over. Slopey's AC/DC shirt, "For those about to rock, we salute you," it said, tore at the neck, but Slopey didn't seem to mind, didn't even seem to be much surprised by Lester's actions, let alone frightened. Lester didn't notice. Lester was beyond noticing nuances. He was one of those large and normally placid men who own a short, nasty temper beneath that placidity, a damaging emotional tornado in waiting. Some men go through their entire lives without ever discovering that ugly storm center. Lester, however, had discovered his, or rather, it had discovered him, and he was now completely in its grip. Holding a swatch of Slopey's T-shirt in a fist which was nearly the size of a daisy canned ham, he bent his sweating face down towards Slopey's. The vein in the center of his forehead was pulsing faster than ever. What do you mean, that's the same guy all right? He's the same guy who met Miss Ratcliffe after school last Friday. He met her after school? Lester asked hoarsely. He gave Slopey a shake brisk enough to rattle the boy's teeth in his head. Are you sure of that? Yeah, Slopey said. They went off in your car, Coach Pratt. The guy was driving. Driving? He was driving my car? John LaPointe was driving my car with Sally in it? Well, that guy, Slopey said, pointing at the driver's license photograph again. But before they got in, he gave her a kiss. Did he? Lester said. His face had become very still. Did he now? Oh, sure, Slopey said. A wide and rather salacious grin lit his face. In a soft, silky tone, utterly unlike his usual rough, "Hey guys, let's go get 'em" voice, Lester asked, "And did she kiss him back? What do you think, Slopey?" Slopey rolled his eyes happily. "I'll say she did. They were really sucking face, Coach Pratt." Sucking face. Lester mused in his new soft and silky voice. Yep. Really sucking face. Lester marveled in his new soft and silky voice. You bet. Lester let go of the Slopester, as his friends called him, and straightened up. The vein in the center of his forehead was pulsing and pumping away. He had begun to grin. It was an unpleasant grin, exposing what seemed like a great many more white, square teeth than a normal man should have. His blue eyes had become small, squinty triangles. His crew cut screamed off his head in all directions. Coach Pratt? Slopey asked.
Is something wrong?
Nope, Lester Pratt said in his new soft and silky voice. His grin never wavered. Nothing I can't put right. In his mind, his hands were already locked around the neck of that lying, pope-loving, teddy-bear-winning, girl-stealing, shit-eating French frog of a John LaPointe. The asshole that walked like a man. The asshole who had apparently taught the girl Lester loved. The girl who would do no more than part her lips the tiniest bit when Lester kissed her. How to really suck face. First, he would take care of John LaPointe. No problem there. Once that was done, he'd have to talk to Sally. Or something. Not a thing in the world I can't put right, he repeated in his new soft and silky voice, and slid back behind the Mustang's wheel. The car leaned appreciably to the left as Lester's 210 pounds of solid hock and loin settled into the bucket seat. He started the engine, gunned it in a series of hungry tiger cage roars, then drove away in a screech of rubber. The slopester, coughing and theatrically waving dust away from his face, walked over to where his skateboard lay. The neck of his old T-shirt had been torn completely away from the shirt's body, leaving what looked like a round black necklace lying over Slopey's prominent collarbones. He was grinning. He had done just what Mr. Gaunt had asked him to do, and it had gone like gangbusters. Coach Pratt hadn't looked madder than a wet hen. Now he could go home and look at his teapot. I just wish I didn't have to stutter, he remarked to no one in particular. Slopey mounted his skateboard and rode away. Sheila had a hard time connecting Alan with Henry Payton. Once she was positive she'd lost Henry, who sounded really excited, and would have to call him back. And she had no more than accomplished this technological feat when Alan's personal line lit up. Sheila put aside the cigarette she'd been about to light and answered it. Castle County Sheriff's Office, Sheriff Pangborn's line. Hello, Sheila. I want to talk to Alan. Polly? Sheila frowned. She was sure that was who it was, but she had never heard Polly Chalmers sound exactly as she did now, cold and clipped, like an executive secretary in a big company. Is that you? Yes, Polly said. I want to talk to Alan. Gee, Polly, you can't. He's talking with Henry Payton right now. Put me on hold. Polly interrupted. I'll wait. Sheila began to feel flustered. Well, I would, but it's a little more complicated than that. You see, Alan's, you know, in the field. I had to patch Henry through. If you can patch Henry Payton through, you can patch me through, Polly said coldly. Right? Well, yes, but I don't know how long they'll be. I don't care if they talk until hell freezes over, Polly said. Put me on hold, and when they're done, patch me through to Alan. I wouldn't ask you to do it if it weren't important. You know that, Sheila, don't you? Yes, Sheila knew it, and she knew something else, too. Polly was beginning to scare her. Polly, are you okay? There was a long pause. Then Polly answered with a question of her own. Sheila, did you type any correspondence for Sheriff Pangborn that was addressed to the Department of Child Welfare in San Francisco, or see any envelopes addressed that way go out? Red lights, a whole series of them, suddenly went on in Sheila's mind. She nearly idolized Alan Pangborn, and Polly Chalmers was accusing him of something. She wasn't sure what, but she knew the tone of accusation when she heard it. She knew it very well. That isn't the sort of information I could give out to anyone, she said, and her own tone had dropped 20 degrees. I suppose you'd better ask the sheriff, Polly. Yes, I guess I'd better. Put me on hold and connect me when you can, please. Polly, what's wrong? Are you angry at Alan? Because you must know he'd never do anything that was... I don't know anything anymore, Polly said. If I asked you something that was out of line, I'm sorry. Now, will you put me on hold and connect me as soon as you can, or do I have to go out and find him for myself? No, I'll connect you, Sheila said. Her heart felt strangely troubled, as if something terrible had happened. She, like many of the women in Castle Rock, had believed Alan and Polly were deeply in love, and like many of the other women in town, Sheila tended to see them as characters in a dark-tinged fairy tale where everything would come right in the end. Somehow, love would find a way. But now Polly sounded more than angry. She sounded full of pain and something else as well. To Sheila, the something else sounded almost like hate. You're going on hold now, Polly. It may be a while. That's fine. Thanks, Sheila. Welcome. She pushed the hold button and then found her cigarette.
She lit it and dragged deeply, looking at the small flickering light with a frown. "Alan?" Henry Peyton called. "Alan, you there?" His voice had the flat, nasal quality voices always have when they are coming through a patch. He sounded like an announcer broadcasting from inside a large, empty saltines box. "Right here, Henry." "I got a call from the FBI just half an hour ago," Henry said from inside his cracker box. "We caught an incredibly lucky break on those prints." Alan's heartbeat kicked into a higher gear. "The ones on the doorknob of Nettie's house? The partials?" "Right. We have a tentative match with a fellow right there in town. One prior, petty larceny in 1977. We've also got his service prints. Now, don't keep me hanging. Who is it?" "The name of the individual is Hugh Albert Priest." "Hugh Priest!" Alan exclaimed. He could not have been more surprised if Peyton had named J. Danforth Quayle. To the best of Alan's knowledge, the two men had known Nettie Cobb equally well. Why would Hugh Priest kill Nettie's dog, or break Wilma Jerzyk's windows, for that matter? "I don't know the gentleman, so I can't say," Henry replied. "Why don't you pick him up and ask him? In fact, why don't you do it right away before he gets nervous and decides to visit relatives in Dry Hump, South Dakota?" "Good idea," Alan said. "I'll talk to you later, Henry. Thanks." "Just keep me updated, Scout. This is supposed to be my case, you know." "Yeah, I'll talk to you." There was a sharp, metallic sound. Bink! As the connection broke, and then Alan's radio was transmitting the open hum of a telephone line. Alan wondered briefly what 9X and AT&T would think of the games they were playing, then bent to rack the mic. As he did so, the telephone line hum was broken by Sheila Brigham's voice, her uncharacteristically hesitant voice. "Sheriff, I have Polly Chalmers on hold. She's asked to be patched through to you as soon as you're available. 10-4? Alan blinked. "Polly?" He was suddenly afraid, the way you're afraid when the telephone rings at 3 a.m. Polly had never asked for such a service before, and if asked, Alan would have said she never would. It would have gone against her idea of correct behavior, and to Polly, correct behavior was very important. "What is it, Sheila? Did she say 10-4? "No, Sheriff, 10-4. No, of course she hadn't. He had known that, too. Polly didn't spread her business around. The fact that he'd even asked showed how surprised he was. "Sheriff?" "Patch her through, Sheila. 10-4. 10-40, Sheriff. Bink! He stood there in the sunshine, his heart beating too hard and too fast. He didn't like this. The bink sound came again, followed by Sheila's voice, distant, almost lost. "Go ahead, Polly. You should be connected." "Alan?" The voice was so loud he recoiled. It was the voice of a giant, an angry giant. He knew that much already. One word was enough. "I'm here, Polly. What is it?" For a moment, there was only silence. Somewhere, deep within it, was the faint mutter of other voices on other calls. He had time to wonder if he had lost the connection, time to almost hope he had. "Alan, I know this line is open," she said, "but you'll know what I'm talking about." "How could you? How could you?" Something was familiar about this conversation. Something. "Polly, I'm not understanding you." "Oh, I think you are," she replied. Her voice was growing thicker, harder to understand, and Alan realized that if she wasn't crying, she soon would be. "It's hard to find out you don't know a person you thought you did. It's hard to find out the face you thought you loved is only a mask." Something familiar, right, and now he knew what it was. This was like the nightmares he'd had following the deaths of Annie and Todd. The nightmares in which he stood on the side of the road and watched them go past in the scout. They were on their way to die. He knew it, but he was helpless to change it. He tried to wave his arms, but they were too heavy. He tried to shout and couldn't remember how to open his mouth. They drove by him as if he were invisible, and this was like that, too, as if he had become invisible to Polly in some weird way. "Annie," he realized with horror whose name he had said and backtracked. "Polly! I don't know what you're talking about, Polly, but..." "You do!" she screamed at him suddenly. "Don't say you don't when you do! Why couldn't you wait for me to tell you, Alan? And if you couldn't wait, why couldn't you ask? Why did you have to go behind my back? How could you go behind my back?" He shut his eyes tight in an effort to catch hold of his racing, confused thoughts, but it did no good. A hideous picture came instead. Mike Horton from the Norway Journal Register bent over the newspaper's Bearcat scanner, furiously taking notes in his pigeon shorthand. "I don't know what it is you think I've done, but you've got it wrong. Let's get together. Talk. No, I don't think I can see you now, Alan. Yes, you can, and you're going to. I'll be... Then Henry Peyton's voice cut in. Why don't you do it right away, before he gets nervous and decides to visit relatives in Dry Hump, South Dakota? You'll be what? She was asking. You'll be what? I just remembered something, Alan said slowly. Oh, did you? Was it a letter you wrote at the beginning of September, Alan? A letter to San Francisco? I don't know what you're talking about, Polly. I can't come now because there's been a break in the other thing. But later... She spoke to him through a series of gasping sobs that should have made her hard to understand, but didn't. Don't you get it, Alan? There is no later. Not anymore. You... Polly, please. No! Just leave me alone. Leave me alone, you snooping, prying son of a bitch. Bink. And suddenly, Alan was listening to that open telephone line hum again. He looked around the intersection of Main and School like a man who doesn't know where he is and has no clear understanding of how he got there.